This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. My name's David Prest.
My name's Camilla McGibbon.
And I must be Keith Davis.
Star of stage and screen, I understand, Keith.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm trying my best. You know, it's amateur dramatics, but it's great fun.
Who are you playing?
I'm playing Digby in a murder mystery. He is the man that comes in and cleans up the dead bodies.
You're the cleaner.
I'm the cleaner.
You're like the Harvey Keitel figure.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So Keith has got a cultural activities on his mind. You've been cultural as well, Camilla.
I have been cultural. I've been watching a fantastic exhibition at Somerset House. Charles Schulz, Peanuts.
Oh,
Charlie
fantastic.
Brown. Good grief, Charlie Brown.
Snoopy,
Lucy, Schroeder.
Favourite cartoon,
Schroeder at the piano. Lucy leaning on the piano trying to get his attention. She's making her Christmas list. I'm going to get this, I'm going to get that. And Schroeder looks up from the piano and he says, softly, where's your gift list?
Profound. I like the way you bring it back to the concept of charity.
Concept of charity.
Talking of which, I've been to the Queen biopic Bohemian Rhapsody. What a blast.
Ooh.
What can I say?
Do and we applaud?
You can do the Fandango, as far as I'm concerned. Galileo Galilei.
Yes.
There's an extraordinary scene at the end where they recreate Live Aid, and I matched it to the original footage of Queen playing, and it is extraordinary. Every coffee cup, every Pepsi can is exactly as was done in 1985. The one character, though, that is almost hilariously bad played in it is the Bob Geldof character. I remember vividly, you know, as a small boy, being quite shocked when Bob Geldof comes on live on telly and is remonstrating and saying, give us your fucking money, and slams the coffee table. In the film, ever so polite, Geldof comes on and says, do give us your money. Do give me your money. In a slight Irish accent.
In
a mangled Irish accent. I don't remember that happening. I think we've got a really interesting guest this week, Karen Bradshaw, who is the head of the Charity Finance Group, is going to be with us. So it's going to be quite a drilled-down look at the way charities manage their finances, maintain their finances, and are looking to the future, building up reserves. I'm hoping to get some really sort of good tips on good financial management, frankly. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there is this whole issue for me about sustainability in the long run for some charities. A lot of charities out there are lurching from grant to grant, you know, and what we've got to try and do is try and help some of those. And I hope that's what we're doing here with Good Charity, Bad Charity. It's interesting because also within part of the information I've read about her is that she's pushing this relationship development, which is important, that you've got to build the relationship, not just go cap in hand for the money. And that for me is another powerful thing that lots of charities need to learn.
Yeah, because that relationship is building trust.
Yep.
And when you build trust as a donor, as a giver, as a funder, you're much more likely to automatically put your hand in your pocket and not spend 3,000 hours doing your due diligence. Mm-hmm. So that is a win-win all around. It's also so important that if something little thing goes wrong and you feel like you're a member of a family, as a donor or as a member of staff, as a trustee, whatever, you then say, oh gosh, what have they done now? In the kind of way that you would say to your family, to your brother, your sister, oh good grief, Charlie Brown, what have you done now? As opposed to this impulse that we now swing into with Twitter or whatever to say, now I'm going to beat you up.
You two have both been involved in running charities and being trustees on charities. Have you ever sort of suddenly realised, oh my God, something's not right here?
Yeah, I think for me a couple of instances have happened. It mainly actually the two that I'm going to sort of quote are both about buildings. You know, you run your charity from a building, you can't really get a grant from a lot of people to maintain and improve that building. It's been really challenging. And at times there are some charity grant aids out there, but they're few and far between.
One of the difficulties is that if charities, by definition, are risk averse because they have to be so careful, then what you can sometimes find is they're putting sums of money into areas of their budget that are saving areas. Mm. So this isn't so much for me about getting money in as about understanding why have we got that money aside to do what with. Mm. And everybody kind of forgets that you may have massive reserves, and then you go for funding, and people go, well, why aren't you spending your own money?
And I think that's very relevant because, you know, if you are looking at people saying how sustainable is this charity, if they're going to give money, they have to accept that sometimes reserves are there to spend on things that you need urgently.
Exactly.
OK, big questions. Let's get Karen Bradshaw in. Here we are. Karen Bradshaw has now joined us, the Chief Executive of the Charity Finance Group. Karen joined the Charity Finance Group in 2010 from the Institute of Chartered Accountants, where she was Head of Charity in the Voluntary Sector. Throughout her career, she's taken on many trustee and advisory roles, serving on the board for a number of small charities, including the Full House Theatre Company in Bedfordshire. Well, let's start off by just explaining, first of all, the Charity Finance Group. How is it organised and what are its aims?
So it's a charity itself, and it started about 30 years ago when a group of finance professionals in mainly the larger charities came together and realised that there was very little in the way of standards across the sector for accounting practices. There was very little support for accountants, and without being derogatory to an awful lot of people holding finance roles back then, there were an awful lot of people that weren't qualified. They'd come from, say, the military or banking or whatever and had done it at the end of their retirement. So basically we exist to try and raise standards to bring financial confidence, because we believe if you can deal with the money side of it, you can have much more bang for your buck.
Because this is really interesting, isn't it? Because we've all seen stories of charities that have just let that side of their business slip and just lose control of it. And, you know, the concept of that culture of fear, almost, of living on your wits and thinking, well, yeah, the next financial year will be better. The next financial year will be better.
Well, people come into the charity sector for causes. They don't come in to manage or to run businesses. But actually, if you want to address causes in an impactful and effective way, you have to manage the business as well.
I think that's so true. In you know, building on the skills of trustees so that you get the right skill mix is very important. I chair a group of charities in Wales, as it happens. How can they join your group, or is it a select? You talk about the membership of your group.
Okay.
So how could they get involved?
Well, it's open to anyone, and not just charities, actually. We'll deal with any social purpose entity. If you're there to deliver public benefit, we're there to support you. But I'll be absolutely honest with you and say that I think for the really small charities, they can get what they need out of us without becoming members. They don't have to pay. And we have a separate charity, small charity website, where we've put an awful lot of models, cash flow forecasts, how to do a budget, lots of real hand-holding, real basic, and then more advanced, detailed guidance for smaller charities, so they don't have to become our members. But right. For the larger ones, where they can really get some benefit from networking with their peers, with other finance professionals, then they simply go onto our website and join.
Thank you.
Do you think that with the emphasis now and people understanding what words, as it were, like reserves mean, that charities are in danger now of taking on only trustees that know about finance? Because there is an issue about who then runs the charity. Does the finance side of it run it, or does the vision side of it run it?
I would say that the vast majority of charities are still, smaller charities particularly, are still in the mindset that finance is something they have to do to comply. So they have to submit accounts, they have to produce financial information. But actually, where we want to go as an organisation is selling the message that finance can be a real enabler of the cause, and that you can't have one without the other. An awful lot of charities really struggle to find finance professionals for their board. And I think that's because they look at the trustee that sits in the treasurer role as being the guardian of all that is finance, and everyone else looks to the finance professional for the answers. When actually what we should be doing is raising the skills of all of the people in the board so that you have that marriage between the finances and the vision, because actually the finances are a means to an end. They're not an end in itself.
What I get from what you're saying is that the training or awareness that is needed to all trustees, okay, is a requirement of the whole board. Therefore, have we got a list of stupid financial questions that trustees could have?
I think that's a jolly good idea, and I'm going to take it back to the ranch.
Good. Well, that's okay. That's what we're here for.
He's all about giving. Yeah. Camilla.
It's all about giving. Trustees get a wadge of paper. And I wonder if you've got any kind of, okay, this is a budget. This is what you should look for as a trustee. At line so-and-so, it will say, blah, blah, blah. Do you get that specific?
Because
I would have found that incredibly helpful when I became a trustee, first off.
Yeah, we do an awful lot of training, and increasingly so. One of the things that we started a couple of years ago in this latest round of strategy for CFG was to try and reach out to trustees much more, because we know you can only take the conversation on so far by talking to the staff inside. You have to talk beyond the finance team. You have to talk beyond the employees. You have to talk to the governance. So we're increasingly trying to support trustees. And in fact, I ran a workshop only a couple of weeks ago where we sat there and went through, what's a cash flow? What does a budget look like?
Excellent.
What do management accounts look like? I think one of the things that we need to do once we've equipped people is to get them out of the mindset that says, we must deliver to the budget. No, the budget is your best guess. And it's probably wrong the minute the ink's dry. What you need to be doing is saying, what does this tell us? This is a proxy for performance.
Yeah.
And when I take it with other performance information, say in a museum, say footfall, or if you're running a coffee shop as part of your activities, the return or the profit margin on something, what are these things telling us?
Can I just twist that slightly then? Mm. Because certainly some of the stuff that I've read about you is that you seem to be promoting social enterprise. That seems to go against slightly the view of charities.
So I would say social enterprise is just another vehicle. I'm not worried whether the vehicle is a registered charity or whether it's a social enterprise, which could be that's a loose term for a whole range of different organisations. For us, it's about the social change piece. So if we can provide skills, not just to charities, but to any vehicle that is seeking to provide social change, then we can make sure that that social change is impactful. I certainly wouldn't assume that the materials we've put out encourage social enterprise. But the other thing I would say is that donations from the public have been relatively flat over the last decade. So charities do have to think about how they might be able to continue to be sustainable. And therefore, trading social enterprise is just one element of that mix. And for some organisations, it would be brilliant. For others, it would be completely the wrong thing, and they ought to be looking at grants or a different mix of income.
I think that's fair, that we have had a couple of people on, and certainly Iqbal, who wrote a book called Charity Sucks, okay, on the basis that he thinks the majority of it should be done by social enterprises. The question that I asked him, and I'm going to throw it at you, I'm afraid, is it okay then to earn a profit from poverty?
It depends what you're doing with that profit, is what I would say.
Okay.
If that profit is to go in your back pocket, then no, it's not. If that profit is to go back in and is being drawn from those who can pay it rather than those who can't, then I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I don't think we should be so squeamish about creating margins on the right things. But we have to ask ourselves what the right things are. And my fear is that the pressure on income will mean that people go after monetizing things that should never be monetized. And therefore, you're seeking beneficiary contributions from the very disadvantaged, least able to afford those things. So profit in itself, yes, but with lots of caveats.
Yes, okay.
Isn't it really difficult? I mean, you know, in this country we have this sort of view and vision of charities as being purely that, almost an idealistic situation whereby we give them a pound and then they pass that pound on to somebody who needs it. Isn't there a fear somehow that, you know, the increase in a sort of social enterprise sort of thing, it will somehow kind of muddy the water that bit more and make the charity sector just a little bit more murky somehow for people?
Well, I would say social enterprise is not a new thing, even though we like to think it is. Social enterprise in one form or another has been going on for not just decades, but hundreds of years.
But not using that phrase.
No, not using that phrase. So some of the oldest and most established charities have effectively been running social enterprises where they have been taking income from those who can afford and redistributing it to those who can't. What I would say is I don't mind if the waters are muddied in the sense of being blind to what the legal construct is that's providing social change. I do mind when we muddy the intelligence around what is charity and what does that word conjure up for people. And I think we have, to an extent, we are reaping a little bit what we sow, in the sense that we have allowed conceptions about what charity means to exist for perfectly good reason, in order to raise money and funds, we have played down the administrative costs that naturally sit behind delivering global services or running very large programmes to support broad ranges of people by saying that the money that you give will 100% go to the front end.
Can I ask a question that you might not be able to answer because it might not be able to be answered? But you talked then about the back office. Do you advise on a percentage of any sort of pound that is okay on the right side but not on the, and above that is on the wrong side? I did say it might not be able to be answered.
No, we don't. And what I would say is, first, I hate the term back office, even though I just used it. I used it because that's what people recognise.
Absolutely.
But there is a legal requirement under charity law that every pound you spend is on the cause. So when we distinguish between charity money, frontline charity spend, and back office being this administrative piece that is almost separate and distinct from the front office, we're fooling ourselves, because that administrative piece is actually part of the charity spend. And if it isn't driving forward in the interest of the beneficiaries and it isn't driving forward our cause, we shouldn't be spending it. And I would say that the percentage piece is also a bit of a hostage to fortune, because it depends on what you're doing. It depends on your mix of income. It depends on the complexity of what you're doing. So for CFG, for example, the biggest cost that we have is staff. It's back office, because we deliver services. And that, therefore, if I had a percentage, I'd be blowing that out of the water. But for others, where you are perhaps predominantly volunteer-led, you may have a minimal back office, but you're still going to have it. You're still going to have an overhead. Mm. If we think that volunteering is free, it's not. It requires some support. And that's what I would distinguish. All money spent by charity should be in furthering its cause.
Mm. We're talking about training and about peer-to-peer conversations. What if you're talking to government? And I assume that you are.
We do.
Do you want out of government?
So I would say, I think at the moment we don't have a great deal of political capital with any political party. Mm. I think we are an afterthought. I've thought it for many years. Often the things that we as an organisation, I use the word campaign loosely, but make representations to government to change the policy position, is not because the government have come up with some remarkable effort to you know, conspire against us. It's because they've not thought about the impact
exactly.
of yep. a thing on the charity sector. So the first thing I would like is for the recognition that, that charity contributes as much to GB PLC as the agricultural sector. It has an economy the size of Cyprus. There is very little in the way of strategic funding of the sector. And in the last budget, for example, we had no mention really to speak of in the Chancellor's speech, and only two or three charity-specific giveaways in the detail.
If you had a sit-down then with, let's say, the new minister, what would you be saying? What would you say? Forget all these giveaways. Forget these little piffling little bits of, you know, gilding at the edges. This is where you should be looking. This is what you should be doing. What would you be saying?
We would be pulling out our submissions for the last probably 5 years.
And, what are in the, what is in those submissions?
And laying them before government. So there are a whole host of different things. For example, if you look at things like the tax environment, we've got a huge tax code. And what we need is for someone to stand back and say, what role do we want tax to play in modern civil society? 1.5 billion comes out of the sector in irrecoverable VAT. We're the only sector that happens to, because for private entities, they flow that VAT through to the customer, and for public entities, they have a clawback provision, often with central government. So there are specific areas where one could go, do you know what? That would be really, really beneficial to the sector as a whole.
Okay.
We do get some very welcome noises, but in the case of irrecoverable VAT, one of the responses has always been, unfortunately, because of state aid rules and the European Union rules, we can't loosen that.
But what about after Brexit?
Well, that's the that was one of the first things that we said in the light of the result. Was
quite everybody be after that point?
So yes, I mean, we did get quite a lot. We did come in actually as CFG for quite a lot of criticism for making the point that there was an opportunity if we are actually going to exit the European Union. there was an opportunity for the UK to rewrite those rules. Whether they actually will is a very different question.
So looking at the bigger picture of Brexit, you mentioned it, what do you think the state of preparedness is amongst the charity sector now? How much do trustees and how much do people running charities really know about, to use the phrase of a Conservative politician, the shitstorm which is coming?
Well, the first thing, I probably should have said this at some point in answer to some of the other questions, is that when we talk about the sector, we tend to lob it all together as one homogenous group of entities. And the reality is 97% of organisations are under £1 million in England and Wales. So when we say the state of preparedness, we're talking about £10,000 kitchen table up to multi-multi-million-pound global enterprise and everything in between. And I would say those organisations that are on the larger end of the scale, who have money directly from the European Union, are probably pretty well prepared, as far as you can be, in scenario planning for what will we do to either replace or scale back or deliver our services in a different way. The group at the other end are probably thinking, well, apart from the impact from, say, a local grant maker that themselves are funded by the European Social Fund, there's not going to be much impact on us. And the group in the middle may well be scratching their heads and wondering what is this all about. So there could be a whole range of different actions going on. And I think people are going to be misleading themselves if they think that, oh, well, I don't get European money, therefore I don't need to worry about this, because there'll be a whole range of other issues, like the impact on the economy as a whole, what will happen to local authority funding.
Can we put a figure on what sort of percentage of charities do you think aren't going to make it on the other side of the Brexit wave?
Oh, crumbs. Well, when we had the crash, that was the biggest, longest, deepest recession we'd suffered since the Depression. And charities got through it. An awful lot of charities got through it. There were some that didn't. And I think that in any economic shocking situation, there will be losers. You will lose some charities. They won't make it through. And some of that will be entirely down to their lack of business acumen and preparedness. For others, it will simply be the people that fund them don't fund them anymore, and there is no other way that they can fund. So I don't think we can say if you don't succeed, it's your fault. I think that's far too simplistic. The argument will be nuanced. I think what you may find is an awful lot more, perhaps larger mid-sized organisations looking for other ways in which they might join forces with others, and not just necessarily partners who are doing similar things in similar spaces, but rather things where they might complement in order to create better impact for reducing amounts of income.
What advice could you give now to the charity who perhaps hasn't really looked into it properly?
And in relation to Brexit?
One thing that they can be doing now that can sort of give them a little bit of confidence in moving forward?
Yeah, I would suggest going back to basics. What are the major things that are going to impact us? Do we actually understand what our business model is? Do we even go further back? Why are we here? What is it we're trying to do? Because I think when you refresh those sorts of questions, you may find that you need to stop doing some of the things that you're doing, and you've only done them for X number of years because you've almost slipped into habit, rather than that this is the best way for us to deliver services or provide outputs to our beneficiaries.
And we shouldn't forget, just for the purpose of the balance, although it's quite difficult to find people in the charity sector being optimistic about it, that there will presumably be opportunities as well post-Brexit.
There may be. I think that if Brexit did nothing else, it showed how divided as a society we've become, how many people have not benefited from the prosperity that we've enjoyed over the last two or three decades. And I think that charities not only have an opportunity, but they have a duty to step into those spaces and to really stamp their authority and say, we're here, this is what we do, and to demand the political capital that says, we're here to be able to provide solutions. We're not just putting our hand out and saying, pay us. We're saying, we are closest to these disadvantaged people, these disadvantaged groups, and we can co-create with those groups solutions to these sticky, problematic areas that have, frankly, evaded answers for many, many years.
Just to change the subject slightly, the subject of trust and falling public trust in charities, obviously, on everyone's minds following Oxfam and clearly other incidents prior to that. And some of the studies that have been done, I'm thinking specifically the Edelman Trust Barometer, which was done quite recently, which certainly gave the indication that this is an area where charities have been damaged. I just wonder, from your perspective, is it likely to affect income, do you think? Is it likely to affect giving?
I would say, and I probably will get up the noses of people like the Charity Commission in saying it, but I think we sometimes get ourselves a bit too hung up on trust and confidence. Mm-hmm. Trust and confidence in the whole sector does not necessarily equate to your individual trust and confidence in the charities that you support. And therefore, you won't necessarily see a fall in donations as a direct result of there being a scandal. Certainly not at a macro level. So if you look at the voluntary giving over the last decade or so, it's pretty much stayed, you know, static, irrespective of this upsurge in scandals over the last 2-3 years. But what you will see is very specific reactions. So if you look at some of the organisations that were on the receiving end of the CEO scandal a few years back, they saw immediate overnight losses in donations. If you look at what happened to Oxfam, there were a whole swathe of people that withdrew their direct debit payments to Oxfam in the light of the Haiti scandal. But there were equally people that went, actually, they need our money right now more than ever, so I'm going to start giving. I was one of those. So you don't necessarily see an immediate drop off in response to scandals. Where I think that you can see a correlation is between what the expectations of the donors are and what the behaviours of the charity are. So if you've got a whole swathe of donors who give because they think it's a good thing to do, but they don't really know what your organisation is, they don't appreciate that you are perhaps running a bigger retail arm than Next, and think therefore you should not be doing that on more than £40,000 a year as the CEO, then you're going to be really shocked to find out that maybe the CEO is on upwards of £160,000-£180,000. If you are, however, an organisation that you're supporting an organisation and you know what it does, you're very familiar with it, you know what its business model is, you may actually be going, why isn't the CEO being paid twice as much as they're currently being paid?
Absolutely.
So I don't think there is an absolute trust and confidence equals lack of donations. I think it's a much more nuanced argument, and we need to stop going, let's beat ourselves up because trust and confidence is going down.
And I have no problem with the amount of money certain chief execs get, as long as they can justify it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the bit that you should be transparent about is your remuneration policy. How do we make this decision? What's the balance that we put in place? How do we strike a balance between rewarding effectively and bringing the right skills and resources in, and not tipping over into paying too much so that we're depleting what's available for our beneficiaries?
The other side of that is, if someone can't justify it, they shouldn't bloody get it. Simple as that for me.
Yeah.
He's blunt. Karen Bradshaw, you are free to go. Thank you very much for joining us. Karen Bradshaw, CEO of the Charity Finance Group, inspiring financial leadership. You can find them at www.cfg.org.uk. Karen, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Wow, what a session. I think for me, I loved her comment about why are we here, and the need now, because of a variety of problems, to go back to why are we here, what are we doing, how are we doing it, and if necessary, we've got to stop salami slicing, which is a typical problem that they face, in saying, well, let's reduce everything we're doing by a little bit, rather than saying, let's cut off something, and don't let's lower the quality of our whole delivery.
Camilla?
For me, the big thing is not to look at the people on a charity board who are the financial so-called experts as if they are the gatekeepers, as if they are the no-sayers, but as if they are part of a creative process. Now, I think sometimes it's quite difficult to look at accountants as if they're incredibly creative. I have sat through some dire meetings, but they have got to be part of it, because they actually, in understanding the particular detail, might venture that by moving a pot of money from this particular cell in the spreadsheet to that particular cell in the spreadsheet, you could make something of an asset.
But it's also that sense that the person who's looking at the balance sheet can also sometimes come up with something quite visionary from left field, from that side of the brain, which perhaps other members of the board haven't got access to. You know, that sense that they can look at the footfall that's affecting cafe revenue and they can therefore multiply that up, or the fact that they can look at disused parts of buildings and, you know, have a sense of what the market value for that might be and therefore realise some asset in that way. There's all sorts of other creative ways in which they can be seen as being very valuable to the organisation.
The other big thing that for me came out of it, this is, how can the charity sector lobby productively. And the challenge I have in my own mind is who the heck is going to lead that? Because I don't think there is any one organisation out there that can lead that big body of people that are involved in it to get the government and people to really respect what is happening out there on the front line.
But it's interesting, so when you look at sort of controlling an economy, and yet, you know, a Chancellor's speech contains very, very little about the charity sector. And if it is, it's in relation to very small pieces of legislation, little bits of giveaway. It's not thinking strategically. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah,
especially when she compared the charity sector and its assets to the GDP from agriculture.
Yeah.
Now, if you were looking at DEFRA, you would know exactly who to lobby, Keith. And I think this is one of the problems. It's fine saying the charity sector needs to coordinate, needs to have a champion. But who does it go to? Does it go to the Prime Minister? Or do you go to the Treasury? Who's holding the money? Or do you go to the Minister for Sport, who happens to have charity as part, even though there is a very loose connection? I think that's one of the major problems.
Yeah, and I haven't got an answer for it. All I'm saying is I think we need to try and find it.
We do. Because
that is going to be a big asset to the whole of the charity.
But I think part of the vision, if you like, for the podcast is it's not about just providing the answers. We cannot provide the answers if we don't know what the questions are. If we can't answer the questions, that's a whole other ballgame. But I think we have to keep pushing the questions out there, and maybe somebody out there will carry the ball.
This has been a particularly fascinating edition, if I can say so, of Good Charity, Bad Charity. You can find us on your podcast provider of choice, or you can go to our website, which is fabulous, goodcharitybadcharity.com. Lots of information about us, lots of information about our previous episodes on there. Our producer is Dan Hardoon. We are here at Whistledown Studios in South London, terribly well-appointed studios available for hire. My name's David Prest.
My name's Keith Davis.
And I'm Camilla McGibbon.